If you were to ask somebody, what is the major topic of Hebrews chapter 7, there's a really good chance that the answer you'd get is, well, it's Melchizedek. And I would suggest to you that that's not right. The major topic of Hebrews chapter 7 is the legitimacy and superiority of Jesus as high priest. Is Melchizedek in there? Oh yeah, he's in there. But Melchizedek is only discussed as an example of the kind of priest that Jesus is. It's not about Melchizedek, it's about him. And the Jewish Christians in the first century must have had a huge problem with the priesthood thing. You know, for generations, centuries, I guess. They had operated under the Jewish system of the old law, and the priesthood was obviously a big deal. The high priest was very highly exalted in that religious culture. And so they must have had a real problem, even though they'd been converted to Christ, kind of. I guess they had. I don't know to what degree they were converted and convinced because of what he accused them of, you know, in chapter 5, when he says, y'all are still sipping on milk and you ought to be eating meat spiritually. But this must have been the priesthood must have been a real stumbling block for them. So what he's trying to do is explain to them that Jesus' priesthood is spiritually legitimate. And what I mean by that is it's the real thing. It's the thing that's now blessed by God. And not only is his priesthood legitimate, it's superior to all this stuff that you have been following for all these generations. It's better. And he really spends a lot of time trying to convince them of that. And I went back through the last few chapters, and it dawned on me that what the writer has done is he dedicated chapters 5, 7, and 8 to the legitimacy of Jesus as high priest. 5, 7, and 8. In 6, he kind of rambled off on the prospects of falling away. But it was a very relevant rambling, because if they reject Jesus as high priest, then they're no longer Christians. And there is a danger of falling away. But remember what he said in chapter 5 when we go back to verses 9 and 10. And having been made perfect, he became, this is Jesus, became to all those who obey him the source of eternal salvation, being designated by God as a high priest according to the order of Melchizedek. Concerning him, we have much to say, but it's hard to explain because you're dull of hearing. Remember that? What he told them? Well, the topic there is, I want to tell you about Melchizedek. It's not, I want to tell you about Melchizedek. The topic there is, I want to tell you about Jesus and how Melchizedek is an example that illustrates the kind of priesthood that Jesus has. And then he goes off on chapter 6 about the dangers of falling away. And then in chapter 7, he resumes the discussion of the priesthood of Jesus using Melchizedek as an example. And then, lest you wonder if that's the case, I love it when the Bible is a commentary on itself. Look at what he says in chapter 8. Now, we might get to that tonight, we might not. But in chapter 8, after all this discussion in chapter 7, the writer says, now the main point in what has been said is this. Lest you wonder what I'm talking about? Here's what I'm talking about. I mean, he just said, here's the main point. We have such a high priest who has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens. So that's the topic. It's Jesus and the legitimacy from their point of view of him being the high priest. And they're saying, wait a minute, he wasn't from the tribe of Levi. He's the tribe of Judah. We're having trouble accepting that. And he says, well, that's why I told you about Melchizedek, because he wasn't from the tribe of Levi either. In fact, Melchizedek was a high priest before there even was a tribe of Levi, or a tribe of Judah. Not tribe of Judah, you know what I mean, Levi. I'm having a geriatric moment. I have those a lot lately. Okay, I'd better check the driver's license and see what it says. Okay, now last time we got into chapter 7, and it does talk about Melchizedek, but he's only talking about Melchizedek as an example of a priesthood that is different from the Levitical priesthood, and not only that, superior to the Levitical priesthood, because remember what Abraham did. He paid tithes to Melchizedek, and it said that the greater blessed the lesser. Okay, then we got down to verse 15, but verse 11, let's just read officially, because that's really what the rest of this chapter is about. Now, if perfection was through the Levitical priesthood, for on the basis of that the people received the law, what further need was there for another priest to arise according to the order of Melchizedek? So, it's a rhetorical question. If the Mosaic law was perfect and you could get forgiveness of sins under that law, then there wouldn't be a need for another priesthood. But there is another priesthood. So what he's also introducing them to is, well, if you're going to have a new priest, a new high priest, Jesus, who doesn't conform to the regulations of the old covenant, for the high priest to be legitimate, there must be a new covenant. Otherwise, he's not a legitimate high priest. And so he's inserting that here. And then he spends chapters 9 and 10 explaining that about the new covenant. Well, there was a comment made at the end of last week about what he says in verse, what verse are we looking at there? 13 and 14. Well, verse 12, well, let's go ahead and get the context. For when the priesthood is changed, of necessity there takes place a change of law also. The old covenant y'all been dealing with, gone. Got to be a new covenant, or the priesthood wouldn't be legitimate. 13, for the one concerning he whom these things are spoken belongs to another tribe, that was Judah, Jesus, from which no one has officiated at the altar. For it is evident that our Lord was descended from Judah, a tribe with reference to which Moses spoke nothing concerning priests. So the comment was made last week, and I gave Branson the chance to make the comment himself or let me make it in his behalf, and he asked me to make it in his behalf. We talk about direct command, approved example, and necessary inference as the way we establish biblical authority. And he said this is a really good example of necessary inference. And the necessary inference here is when you consider the facts of the case, since Jesus is a high priest, and since he doesn't conform to the regulations of the old covenant, and since his priesthood is legitimacy, necessary inference is we must have changed covenants. Is that the way you said it? Yeah. So that's a good example of necessary inference. It's a conclusion that is inescapable. It must be drawn by consideration of the facts that are given. Okay. Now, I like the way, you know, he's really trying hard to convince them, and he uses some phrases that we use. I love the way in 18 he says, on one hand there's this, but on the other hand there's that. And then you go down to verses 23 and 24, and he says, you got this on one hand, and on the other hand you got that. We say that today. So they were saying that in the first century. And then he also says something that I sometimes chuckle at when a biblical writer is talking about a complicated issue. And he says in verse 15, and this is clearer still. And I'm thinking, well, it might be very crystal clear to you, but some of us have to look at this pretty hard for it to be crystal clear still. But anyway, let's read verses 15 through 17. Okay, what is clearer still? Well, that Jesus is a high priest and that there's a new covenant. That's what's clearer still. 15, this is clearer still. If another priest arises according to the likeness of Melchizedek, and obviously that's Jesus, who has become such not on the basis of a law of physical requirement, but according to the power of an indestructible life. For it is, and then he quotes Psalm 110:4, which says, for it is attested of him, you are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. He says, now let me enhance the power of the statement that Jesus' priesthood is legitimate. It is the real thing. He says, now, there's another priest after the order of Melchizedek who his priesthood was obviously superior to the Aaronic priesthood based on what Abraham did with him. But with Jesus, he says, he's not a priest because of a physical requirement. He's not a priest because he came out of a certain tribe. He's a priest because of the power of an indestructible life. Now that word, I don't know what your translation says. The King James has an everlasting life. And I read what this word challenged me as I kept reading about it and reading what other people had to say about it, so I finally looked it up. And if you look up in Vine's Interlinear, the word here that's in the New American Standard, indestructible, is indissoluble. Well, I don't know that I've ever said indissoluble before. Indissoluble. But it means impossible to destroy. You know, we talk about, if for those of you who suffer through chemistry, you pharmacy people, some things are soluble, some things are insoluble. Well, soluble means it dissolves in water, doesn't it? And insoluble means it doesn't dissolve in water. Yeah, okay. And this is not that. At first, that's what I thought that was. But this is dissoluble versus indissoluble. And it came into the English language in the 1500s. And it really means incapable of being destroyed. It's indissoluble. And that's why Jesus is a high priest. Not because he came out of the tribe of Levi, because he came out of Judah. But he's a high priest because he is eternal. Now, you know, I've mentioned to you that some of this argument appeals a lot to them and what they knew because of their Jewish background. But we're getting into the part of this chapter now that should really appeal to us. Because all the things he tells them that makes Jesus superior as a high priest and what he can do for them as Christians that the Old Testament high priest couldn't do, Jesus is also doing for us. So I'm intensely interested in what Jesus is doing for me. I need it. You all need it. We all need it. So he says in 16, he's a high priest because of his indissoluble life, indestructible, eternal. And then it quotes Psalm 110 to emphasize that. And it says, "For it's attested of him, you are a priest forever, according to the order." And the word to be emphasized here that the author is talking about is, "You are a priest forever." Forever. Well, I can't fathom forever, but that's what it is. He's a priest forever. Okay, then 18 and 19, he kind of clarifies a little bit. "For on the one hand, there is a setting aside of a former commandment." What's that? The old law. "Because of its weaknesses and uselessness." And then in parentheses, the translators put, "For the law made nothing perfect." Now, I don't know where that parenthetical comment appears in your Bible, but for some reason they put the parenthetical comment in my Bible in verse 19, and it's addressing what was said in verse 18. Why did they put that in verse 18 with what it's talking about? I don't know. I guess we have to ask those people. But anyway, that was the flaw in the old law. He said, this is the former commandment because of its weakness and uselessness. It's being set aside. Well, that's a big deal to them because they were having trouble setting it aside. "For the law made nothing perfect. But on the other hand, there is a bringing in of a better hope through which we draw near to God." A better hope. Why do we have that hope? Well, because of what Jesus did. What does it mean to draw near to God? There's that. And this is one of those guess what I'm thinking things. This is also used down in verse, where else does it say draw near to God? Somebody help me. What other verse? Where is it? 25. Okay. "Therefore, he is able to save forever those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession to them." And I got to thinking about what does it mean to draw near to God, and what you said is obviously correct. But what is it that separates us from God? Sin. So what is it that keeps us from drawing near to God? Sin. And who made it possible for our sins to be atoned for that allows us to draw near to God? Jesus. Our high priest, who offered himself as the sacrifice for our atonement. So what that means is Jesus made it possible through his sacrifice for us to draw near to God when we had separated ourselves from God because of our sin. And he's making that point to them, and he says, "You Jewish Christians in the first century, I hope you get it." And what I'd say is for us Christians in the 21st century, I hope we get it. That's what he's doing for us. Without the sacrifice of Jesus, we could not draw near to God. Because of our sin, we'd be separated indissolubly.
Well, a lot of
that are looking for what? Which verse are we talking about?
Verse 18.
Okay.
New King James says, because of its weakness and unprofitableness. I don't know what your version says.
Weakness and uselessness.
And some point to that say, you know, this was God's law through Moses. And it failed. Well, the law of Moses did exactly what God intended it to do. It was no failure on God's part. And in a sense,
it was perfect for its purpose. Now go ahead and officially tell us, what was the purpose? What was the purpose of the old law, according to Galatians 3? A schoolmaster to lead us to Christ. And did it do that? Sure it did. Go ahead. Well, those comments are based on, and I don't mean to be mean-spirited here, but one, either prejudice, because they don't want to believe it anyway, no matter what you tell them, or ignorance. And when I say ignorance, that's not stupidity. That means they don't understand what the Bible concept is. You know, the Bible tells us that God planned this whole thing before the foundation of the world. This is just exactly what he planned to happen. Were you going to talk? Yeah, and then you.
I was looking at verse 19 while he was looking at 18 again. For the law made nothing perfect, and it didn't. It got you as close as it could, but every year they had to have the remembrance made of their sins and have them roll forward. It did not allow us into the presence of our people, into the presence of God. But the latter half said, at the bringing in of a better hope,
yeah. And when were the sins of the Old Testament ultimately forgiven? On the cross. Jared?
We're going to get to this, I guess, maybe next week. But in chapter 8 and verse 8, we find out that the problem wasn't the law. It makes it perfectly clear. God doesn't do anything that's not perfect. The problem was the people. People didn't keep the law perfectly.
Yeah.
It wasn't a problem with him. It was a problem with them.
Yeah. Well, if somebody kept the law perfectly, they'd be saved, wouldn't they? Nobody did it. Anybody else? Okay. Well, let's see. Have we covered 18 and 19? I guess we have. Okay. Let's do 20 through 22 here. And inasmuch as it was not without an oath. Okay, now what he's doing here. Remember, back in the previous chapter, was it the previous chapter? I think it was, where God swore with an oath, and we discussed that. So what he's got is the same principle going here, and what he's going to explain to them is the old law and that whole priesthood thing was not attested by an oath by God, but this one is. And he's saying that makes something sure, even more sure. And so that's the reasoning here in verses 20 through 22. And inasmuch as it was not without an oath, this new priesthood of Jesus and the covenant, for they indeed became priests without an oath. God didn't make an oath about the Old Testament priesthood. But he with an oath, through the one who said to him, the Lord has sworn and will not change his mind, you are a priest forever. And then also after the order of Melchizedek, Psalm 110, verse 4, says that. So what he's saying is God felt so strongly about this that, again, he used an oath to install Jesus as the priest forever. And then 22, so much the more also Jesus has become the guarantee of a better covenant. Well, that verse we could talk about for a long time. Jesus is the guarantee of a better covenant. Okay, let me just pose two questions and see if anybody wants to comment on them. One of them is, thinking about Jesus, how was the new covenant a better covenant, and how is Jesus a guarantee of it? Anybody want to comment on that? Okay, I will. It was a better covenant because through that covenant, thanks to Jesus' death on the cross, there was forgiveness of sins, which wasn't under the Old Testament. So how is Jesus a guarantee of this covenant? Well, what is it that we are promised if we remain faithful as Christians? We're promised that we're going to be raised and live eternally. Isn't that right? Who is it who has been raised and is living eternally? It's Jesus. So Jesus is the one responsible for both of these things. He's the reason why it's a better covenant, because thanks to his death, we have forgiveness of sins. That's much better than what the old one was. And he's also the guarantee of it, because he rose from the dead and is living eternally, and that's the promise we have. Now Jesus is the guarantee of that. And where's Ashley? Where are you? When somebody's going to buy a house, don't they put down some guarantee money? $3,000 or $5,000 or whatever it is, and they say this is the money. What do they call that? I forget. Earnest money, yeah. Go put down the earnest money, and if we don't buy the house, we forfeit this money. Well, it's a guarantee. And that's what Jesus did for us. It's a sure thing. It's going to happen. So Jesus, I mean, what's really powerful to me is Jesus is responsible for both of these things. He's the reason why it's better, and he's the reason why it's a guarantee. Comments? Okay, do the next year. For some reason, I like reading verses in clusters of three. It seems to make sense. They just work out that way. Okay, the former priest, and here we go with one hand and the other hand. The former priest, on the one hand, existed in greater numbers because they kept dying. If you're really going to be blunt about it, they existed in greater numbers because they were prevented by death from continuing. All these guys died. When one of them died, another one took his place. And then 24, but Jesus, on the other hand, because he continues forever, he's indissoluble, holds his priesthood permanently. And what he's doing is presenting one contrast after another. Look, under the old law, you all had this. Under the new law, you got this. Under the old law, you had sin. Under the new law, you got forgiveness. Under the old law, you got guys that kept dying all the time. And under the new law, you got a guy who's going to live forever. Under the old law, the priesthood lasted until one guy died, next one took his place. Under the new law, that's never going to happen again because Jesus is going to live eternally. So you first century Christians who are coming out of Judaism, don't you see why this is better? Don't you see why you don't want to go back to the old way? And of course, this is relevant for us. And then 25. Therefore, he is able to save. Okay, there's some such key words in here for them and for us. Jesus is able to save, which nobody under the Old Testament could do. Forever, which nobody under the Old Testament could do. Those who draw near to God, which nobody under the Old Testament could do, because we get forgiveness of our sins through him, since he always lives, always, to make intercession for them. So the Old Testament priests who kept dying had to offer sacrifices for themselves first, because they were all sinners, and then try to offer sacrifices for the rest of the people. But what we have here is Jesus himself, who's eternal, who's making intercession for us now. And again, I can see the writer saying, do you see? Do you see why this is better? So it clearly is. Comments? Okay. Well, let's read 26 through 28. For it is fitting for us to have such a high priest, Jesus. Now, here are the characteristics of Jesus. He's holy, and we know that comes from a word that means set aside for a particular purpose, special purpose, and that's what he was. He was innocent, which is sinless. He was undefiled. He has none of the stains that come from being a sinner. He was separated from sinners. I mean, you can't even talk about him in the same bolt of cloth as you talk about sinners. So these are just three different ways of saying he was sinless. And he was exalted above the heavens. What Old Testament priests are exalted above the heavens? I don't know of any. And he keeps saying, this is who's on your side, Christians. This is who's on your side. Come on. 27, who does not need daily, like those high priests, to offer up sacrifices first for his own sins and then for the sins of the people, because he did once for all when he offered up himself. And what were they doing under the old law? When they had the tabernacle was bloody all the time because they were offering all these sacrifices. I sometimes wonder, what'd they do with all that blood? How'd they get rid of all that stuff? I don't know. But Jesus only had to be offered one time. One time. For us. And that's all it took. And he did not have to offer for his own sins because he was sinless. Like they did. So it's another comparison. You got all these sinning guys who keep dying and they can't do anything for you. And they're certainly not up above. And then you got Jesus who offered himself as a sacrifice one time. And he's now up there interceding for you. Why in the world would you think about going back to what you had? Now, they must have had a real problem with it because he sure is investing a lot of argumentation here on convincing them that they need to stay with Christ. Then 28, for the law appoints men as high priests who are weak, but Jesus is strong. But the word of the oath, what oath is he talking about? The oath that's in Psalm 110:4, which was made after the Old Testament priesthood was already established. So it's talking about the priesthood of Jesus and it being eternal. The word of the oath, which came after the law was already in existence when that oath was made, appoints a son made perfect forever. And when he says son, that's not casual lingo. That's the Son of God. And it says he's made perfect forever. That perfect there doesn't mean sinless. It means he is the one who totally, 100% accomplishes his purpose as our high priest. Man, that's powerful stuff for us to know that that's what Jesus is doing on our behalf. He is our high priest, and he's making intercession for us now. And because he rose from the dead, that is our guarantee that we're going to rise from the dead too. Unbelievable. Powerful message. Yeah, and that's in the first. Yeah, that's in the first verse of chapter 8. You're not trying very hard. Well, that's you're going back to chapter 3 where he talked about Moses was the servant in the house, but Jesus is the son over the house. Clearly a contrast. And Jesus is superior every way you think to compare. Every way. Every way. And if we were facing the same choice that these first century Christians who came out of Judaism were facing, wouldn't this choice be a no-brainer? I mean, it seems to me it would. I want the one that's eternal. I want the one that has, that offers sinlessness. I want the one that offers eternal life. That's the one. Why do I want to go back with all this bloody stuff, with all these sinners that keep offering animals that can't offer me atonement for my sins, forgiveness of my sins? Why would I want that? But I think the fact that he goes in such persuasive detail on this indicates the degree to which they were being pulled back to their traditional ways. And has human nature changed? Aren't we all comfortable with doing it the way we've always done it? So, you know, sometimes somebody who is a faithful member of a denomination said, I don't know, I have a hard time buying this, what you're teaching. You know, well, I understand that. Everybody has that problem. Well, it was not only religious, it was cultural. Sure, I would contend that human nature hadn't changed at all. And don't you know, just a second, don't you know when the high priest walked through a town that everybody stopped, well, there's the high priest. Hey, how you doing, high priest? And people bow and all this kind of stuff. And now all of a sudden, that's gone. I mean, that's a huge cultural change. And now not only is Jesus our high priest, but how are we described? We're a royal priesthood. All of a sudden, these people who've been bowing and scraping at the high priest are now told, you're a priesthood. Matt? That's right. Not only is it comforting, it's convenient.
Yeah, I show up to feasts, I show up once a year off my sacrifices, and I go back and I do my job.
Yeah, oh, by the way, here's a pigeon.
Yeah.
Kill it for me. Yeah. Well, even for them, you can show up in advance and have it sacrificed before you even do it. Anybody else have any comments? Human nature is the same. I would contend that human nature has been the same ever since Adam and Eve. I mean, what was Adam's response to God? The woman you gave me, it's her fault. So we've been trying to dodge guilt for a long time, thousands of years. Okay, any other comment? Yeah. Wait, I can't hear what you're saying. Oh, yes, okay. Yeah. Well, who do we have to go through to get that? Jesus. Which is one more way in the New Testament that tells us that salvation is through Jesus Christ. It's not through Mohammed or somebody else like that. It's Jesus. Okay, well, let's go to Larry's verse here. Chapter 8, verse 1. Now, and I love the way he says, y'all wonder what I've been talking about? It hadn't been Melchizedek. Now the main point, I don't know what your version says, but New American Standard says, now the main point in what has been said is this. We have such a high priest. We've got him. Who has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens. Now, what does it mean to be at the throne? Well, you're up there. What does it mean to be at the right hand of the throne? That's the place of honor. Why, if someone has a task to do, does he take a seat? Because he's completed his task. That's what he's done. And where is he? At the throne of the majesty in the heavens. So that describes Jesus. He did exactly what he set out to do. He's now in a place of honor at the right hand. He is seated because he's finished it. He has no more work to do except to intercede for us. And he's at the throne of the majesty in the heavens. And the writer is saying to them, thanks to that, you can be there too. That's why I say it's no longer just mildly interesting to people who used to be Jews. Now it's intensely interesting to those of us who are trying to be Christians. Okay, Jesus in verse 2 is a minister in the sanctuary, but he'll have to minister next Wednesday. I very much appreciate your comments. Thank you, and we'll take